continues. The tactical task to breathe fire has now been issued. Good to go. You will breathe fire day in and day out for the next 2 months. You will breathe fire in your sleep. You will feel fatigue. You will feel fear. You will feel happiness. You will feel regret. You will feel sadness. At the end of the day, you will continue to breathe fire. Good to go. Okay, with that said, you will take the operational instinct, and here's what I tell you to do, and it's almost one of those impossible tasks, but you gotta fight for it every day. You gotta use that operational instinct, and you gotta know what happens before it happens. You gotta stay methodical on the field. You gotta stay clear-headed on the field. You gotta work any resource as required to move like this. Move methodical and ensure you always have mutual support in position to affect the fight and bring fire as required to fucking kill the enemy. Kill the enemy! Kill the enemy! Kill the enemy! Gonna go! We are going to have the required obligation and strength to protect those who need to be protected. Getting hit on the battlefield is going to be very challenging, but don't ever forget this. You are obligated to protect and serve the Marines on the left and right flank of you 24/7. Good to go. Yeah. You will all come home together. Good to go. Yeah. To exploit the opportunity you have to call home to your loved ones, get right with your God. You might not all make it back, all right? We need to come to terms with that. The strength of the wolf is the pack. The strength of the pack is the wolf. You have to be able to rely on that Marine to your left and right, just like the CO said, and he has got to be able to rely on you. If you're an atheist, play along.
Giving you the matter of facts. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. Back on the podcast after, a little over a month hiatus is Chantel Taylor, British Army Combat Medic. Chantel, what's up?
Hey, John. How's it going?
Good, good. You took a little trip. You were gone for a little over a month.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I was working. Some of us have got to go and work.
Yeah.
It was nice. It was a nice. I call it work, but it was. I was in a nice place.
Nice. That's cool. Yeah. I took a little mini vacation myself, so it was. You know, even if you're not doing anything super spectacular, sometimes just taking some time off is really good and kind of good for the soul. You know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think because the UK's so cold and sometimes a little bit miserable, it was nice to get somewhere warm, you know, and have a little bit of a break in the sun.
Right. Okay, so for this episode, I had an interview with a former Navy corpsman who was attached to the Marine Corps, and he had a few deployments as a corpsman with a Marine unit to Afghanistan. And then he got out of the military, and now he's linked up with the Global Surgical Medical Support Group, and they're doing some really good things over in Iraq, and now they're trying to get into Syria. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting concept to get out of the military but still work in a way where your skills and your specialty is highly valuable and used. this is something that you have a lot of experience with, Chantel. Did you feel like there was a major difference in working as a medic in the British Army and then working as a medic outside of the military?
I think it was almost, I mean, especially for me, it was almost like a natural progression. And I don't know what that sort of, the transition was, but I wasn't ready to come home. And I think most soldiers, and for sure medics, when you come back from an operational tour, and then what happens is you go into a different cycle, whether that be training or whether it be just logistically your units regrouping, it goes very flat. So I literally left the military, and within a month I was back in Afghanistan as a private contractor. But I must say, you know, that depending on what job you go into, I worked with Department of State and then Department of Defense, and we were training Afghan medics. So it was very much, I still felt very, very much part of what I'd been in Afghanistan before, you know. So it was, for me, it was quite, I felt like I needed to do it, you know, because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I definitely knew I wanted to leave the army at that point, but I didn't. I was a little bit unsure, and the military is not great at guiding you into what, where you should be. And I'm quite headstrong, and I thought, right, I want to go back. And then, that sounds crazy. And then I stayed there for 2 years doing that job. I felt very much still part of what was happening, because we had Marines, US Marines in our little FOB. And then, you know, I had a Navy corpsman working with me. So what I'd sort of lost when I left the military, I just picked right back up again.
Right. And a month, really, that's a very short time, you know, to kind of make that jump, you know. And that was a month after you returned from a deployment, or a month after you had separated from the military?
No, I returned from my final deployment, and then did a year back in the unit, which was almost like it was a bit of a training cycle. And then also I had to do all of the courses to leave the military. And I was still, you know, I love the military. So I didn't leave because I was sort of you know, sad or anything like that. I was still kind of hungry to do stuff. And I thought, well, I gave half of my working life to the military. What else is there? And I'd got to a point where I was moving fairly quickly up the ranks. And I knew that my last deployment would be the last time that I would have been in a combative situation. And again, this may sound foolish, and looking back, it probably was, but I wasn't ready to not be in that situation. I felt like I was at a point in my career where that's where I felt I added most value. I wasn't ready for an office. Right. Probably not ready for an office now, and maybe that's just what's in us.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I have a lot of friends who are at that point where they're retiring or thinking about retiring, you know, mid-30s, early 40s. But it's still an age where you're still physically capable, you know, unless you've been through some kind of horrific injuries.
And yeah, I think, sure.
You know, with that kind of training and years of doing it, and I feel like you would still feel like there's more to do and you're kind of not finished. And part of, I think, and this is something that we discussed on previous episodes, like part of the transitional process where some people get lost is where they lose that kind of sense of purpose. And once you lose that, you know, people kind of let their minds go astray and then they kind of forget who they are. And that's when they kind of get into that dark hole, you know?
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, when I left, I became fitter. I became stronger because I kind of learned the stuff that I lacked previously. I knew, we all know our own bodies and what we can do with them. So because I knew that I'd left the military, which was, you know, you're always offered all of that support. And so I'm not saying that I was on my own, but you have to be almost like the very best you can be, because if shit heads south quickly, generally you're not going to have the same support you did in the military. I was lucky in some situations, but I was just very aware that that would be the case. So I got really physically strong and fit, and I'd learned an awful lot of new skills when I left, and And some part of me then, actually, after that 2 years that I'd had out and then another four in Baghdad, I'd probably say that I was probably in a good like frame of mind to go back in and potentially I'd learned that much more that I probably would have been like more effective, if that makes sense. Although I was fine, I was, you know, in the military, but I just kept adding more strings to my bow, and you know, and I became, I don't know, I had just a wider view. You know, I'd worked with far more different types of forces, different units, and right. just ensured that I kept. Yeah, and you're right about the dark hole too. Is that if you do, and I don't know whether sometimes, you know, when we discuss the PTSD issues, I think that it's actually tougher coming leaving the military sometimes than what you've seen. I think that's a really hard thing to deal with. Like if you've been a soldier that served, you know, any length of time, or in particular a career soldier that's been in there your entire adult life, actually leaving the military is more scary than doing anything.
Right.
Because you become nothing again. It's almost like you still got your friends that are in the military, but you are either a Mr. or Miss or a Mrs. You're no longer inside. You feel like you're still a soldier, but your life changes. And right. I think that's actually a lot of the time with things like PTSD, that's very much a massive part of it. But it's something that's not really looked into. You know, everyone's looking into, oh, well, you must have seen really bad shit. Well, actually, at that time, it was okay because I was with a group of people that were seeing the exact same bad shit. So you still felt that cohesive, and you're very much part of that group. When you leave that group, that's when the problems start.
Right. So, Chantel, let me ask on the medical side of things. Mm-hmm. You know, here in the States, and I'm sure in the UK as well, after such a long extended period of fighting, you know, there were advancements made on the medical side for, you know, Western units and people are getting out and kind of running courses and doing that and really helping bring up the overall level of knowledge when it comes to like TCCC, bleeding control, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, and like you said, you've worked with different medics, corpsmen, you know, from different units and nations post-military. Would you say that in the contracting world, the level of medical skill is, you know, up to par, at least if you're going to try and compare it maybe to like an active duty military unit?
Well, you know, in some ways, because you have more freedom, and I think it's much of a muchness because, you know, you must always keep that same standard. You must never sort of lose that. And in some ways where you're no longer in the military and maybe where kits not as readily available, you do have to think on your feet. But I think I was very much of the mindset of not to get too clever with it. You know, that you can't, the basics work, you know, and the basics done well are always going to be your sort of saving grace. So that those are the sorts of things that are never going to leave you. You know, identifying a need for early surgery, stopping the bleed, patient positioning, all of that good stuff. I found, I suppose my one bugbear about in the private sector is that what was happening is I've came across, and not all of them, but several contractors that will go and do a med course and then they're all of a sudden a medic. And, it pisses you off because I think, well, you can do a course, you've got, you know, a couple of patients, but the reality is that are you prepared for a mass casualty incident? As most senior medics, you know, would have either been involved in or at least be party to, especially if you've been on a few tours or you've certainly maneuvered around those sorts of units. So that can get a tiny bit frustrating because you can almost hear them, you know, reading verbatim from a sort of a medical pamphlet, but what you don't get in those sort of pamphlets is real life experience and the nuances of dealing with not only casualties but dealing with people that are in what you can call sort of battle shock and run it, and just basically controlling a scene a bit better than just concentrating on casualties, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it does. And so I have a question. So for you, you know, your official title in the British military was a combat medic, right? Now, after you go through your like basic training, like basic soldiering, how long is the schooling for you to like officially be designated a combat medic and be ready to deploy, kind of thing?
Okay, well, we have different levels. So you start off as a combat, well, when I joined, it sounds an awful long time ago, not that long. But so you start off, you go and you do your, like you say, basic training, and then you go, and I think, if I can even remember, combat medics of level 3. And then you leave your trade training as a combat medic level 2, which was approximately a year. So then you have to go to a field unit, and that's when you're basically, you know, you're learning all the crap, like painting boxes and humping and dumping kit and all that sort of crap. And then you can basically assist a combat medical technician class 1. And then you go back to what's known as our depot, our training, which is a tri-service depot. So you have all the Navy, Air Force and Army doing their courses together. And then you do another 6 weeks of your class 1 kind of work, which is more of the sort of surgical interventions. And just, I suppose, because you've been, you can deploy as a class 2, but you're usually assisting someone. And I'll say this, you know, I've had class 2 medics underneath me in operational theatres, and they're worth their weight in gold. You know, I wouldn't even potentially have to supervise them in some circumstances, but they always have a class 1 as a buffer. And I suppose legally, right, that's generally how you deploy. But you can't say, if you're attached to an infantry company and then, you know, you come under contact and the class 1 happens to be on the other side of a track to the class 2, then the class 2 is not going to be doing nothing. Do you right. see what I'm saying? So, but anyway, that's generally, so you have a class 1 that's there to kind of guide you and all that sort of stuff. The class 1 will also do the, what we call the Battlefield Advanced Trauma Life Support course, which is all the, again, surgical airways and all that sort of stuff before they deploy. And also you get all the pre-deployment sort of medical training. I used to run that for the brigade that I deployed with. And, you know, you make full use of teams like Amputees in Action, and you use sort of battle simulation all sort of encompassed into one big exercise. And that kind of, that can sort out the potentially who the suitable frontline medics are to who's suitable to potentially be back in the main operating bases. Does that make sense?
Right. So kind of like in terms of having the ability to work under pressure or potentially handle like a mass casualty event.
Yeah. And some people, and there's no shame in it. Some people, it's not, I mean, I think generally, you know, wherever you are, you've got to be sort of prepared to deal with it. But we do the very best that we can in training to try and mirror what happens in the field. But then you can't really add to that the proper emotions, because people, You can put as much smoke in bat sims and all that sort of good stuff, but it still doesn't simulate what happens on the battlefield, really.
Right.
Especially if it's one of your own injured or, you know, all that sort of stuff. But having said that, I think people probably generally do better on the battlefield than they do in training, because I always used to feel a bit like you're always under a lot of pressure, but when you're out there, it doesn't seem to, you feel under less pressure because just seems to kick in. And you haven't got like a million doctors watching you, you know, why did you do that? Why, you know, all that sort of bollocks. And so you tend to, you're a bit more free to actually think about what you're doing.
Right. And I would also imagine that you're probably kind of a little more motivated as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't want to let the guys down around you, and you certainly don't want them to see that you're flapping. I always used to remember, like, people would tell you, you know, you're always really calm. And I'm not calm at all. But you have to kind of look a bit like that. You can't run around saying, oh, you know, everyone's going to die. You know, you can't really have that sort of, that doesn't instill confidence in the people around you. But, but there's always fun and games to be had, isn't there?
Right. So you've had different tours in the military, like, where you've worked in a field hospital, and then you've also had tours where you were out, you know, attached to an infantry company.
Yeah. And I had tours that were, again, less kinetic than the Afghanistan-Iraq tours. And to be honest, I was quite glad of them because they kind of it was almost like, if I look back at my career, it was almost like it was built, I don't want to say perfectly, but the sort of building blocks, it was just slowly, slowly building up to that. Does that make sense? And that wasn't because it was, I think I just got lucky. I saw a little bit in Kosovo and then I saw a bit more in Sierra Leone and it was just sort of slowly building. So maybe, I don't know, I just got lucky in that sense. Whereas imagine being a junior medic being thrown into, you know, Helmand Province or, you know, in the Sada city. I mean, that's got to, you know, you can just sort of imagine how that would feel. I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing. Maybe, I mean, obviously people stepped up. But I'm quite happy and quite sort of, I felt quite privileged to have the kind of army upbringing that I did. You know, I was lucky. Right, and yeah, so, like you say, so the hospital side, although, again, it wasn't kinetic, it was very, quite emotionally, quite hard. Because all you see is the doom and gloom. You know, all you see is people in shit state. And then, and again, you see the emotions. Whereas when I was a medic at the front, you see a very different type of soldier. You see people are still, it's all kicking in. People are doing what they need to do and then getting the patient on the bird to get back to the hospital. The guys at the receiving end at the hospital are the ones that really do a lot of the shitty work. You know, and I mean, every sort of time, I remember even pulling a nurse's shift. They were that sort of snowed under. I said, yeah, I'll do a shift. And it was probably the hardest 12 hours. I was like, this is crap. Because you just, not only are you having to care for patients, you're having to do all the cleaning and all of, you know, it was a tough 12 hours. And like I said, you're just dealing with all the sadness, you know, you're dealing with a lot of the emotional stuff. And that was quite hard going.
Right. And I would imagine, like, you know, maybe someone who's a nurse, like, let's say not in the military.
Yeah.
And they did it because, you know, they thought it would be a good career choice. They make good money and benefits and that kind of thing. Versus someone who has an emotional attachment and believes in what's going on and you know, believes in her fellow soldiers. And I would imagine that makes it a little more difficult emotionally. But so you've had some interesting experiences on deployment, you know, in war zones. Would you be able to share a story with the audience of maybe a time where you had to treat somebody, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a few incidences like that, John. Pull up a sandbag. No, I'm kidding. So we had like when on my final deployment, which is obviously the most fresh, I had a group of younger CMTs, combat medics. And so we were treating a fair amount of casualties in our patrol base. And I just became very aware of, even when we were treating Afghan casualties, of that you're always surrounded by armed Afghans, you know. And so, and we didn't have a doctor with us. So of our group, I was the senior medic, and you know, I was like very well prepared for that role, but it was still, I not only like medically, I felt very much responsible for my medics. You know, I didn't want to be telling parents how, you know, how someone had been hurt. And, you know, that was quite a tough call. And then, so, I mean, I suppose from a medical perspective, we had just one incident in particular. We had a call sign coming into us, and they were hit with a direct hit with an RPG. And they were quite close. They were hit quite close to the patrol base. And then they were brought in, and the whole inside of the what's known as a Pinsgauer, which is one of our military style vehicles. So that was in shit state. You know, the guy on top cover had, I think he'd been shot in the head. So he'd taken a direct round to the head, but they weren't signs of life, but he was maneuvering. I'm not saying maneuvering, but he was showing signs that people potentially could have thought he was still alive, but he wasn't. So I suppose having to dealing with patients that are still very much need your care, and then, but dealing with the emotional side of having to kind of pronounce someone dead when I'm in really no position to do that. I'm not a doctor, but you still have to take on that responsibility. That can get quite complex. And that did actually, that was kind of, And I always found after every casualty incident, I mean, bearing in mind, I'll put it into perspective. So over a period of 6 days, we had 30 casualties. And over a period of 7 weeks, we had 66 casualties with four dead. So over every single casualty incident, you always had this feeling of exhaustion. But the worst it was, you're always exhausted, but you always knew you had to. It wasn't a case of like, I've got jet lag at the moment, so I can obviously get my merry little head down and think, oh, I might have a little lie-in tomorrow. But it's not like that. You have to keep finding the energy from somewhere. You have to keep, right. And then add to, and this isn't poor me. This is just generally how soldiers, medics are. So, and bearing in mind your rations are low, you know, then from the grunt's perspective, their ammunition's low, water's at a premium, because you can't just, you know, it's not like you can just have an ever sort of increasing amount of kit that you just jump into. Does that make sense? And then and most of all, for me as a medic, med supplies were so low. You know, I remember looking at my med kit thinking, I've not got enough to sustain us, and saying to my company commander, you know, and being quite frank and quite honest. And I know, you know, we ended up with quite a solid relationship where I could talk to him like that. And you know, clearly you had Sir on the end. It didn't become like we were best muckers. But there was that understanding that I could go and say, you know, we're fucked. And we need medical kit. And then he, I think you get to a point where people, once you've got a few weeks together in combat, everyone understands, you know, they know if you're bluffing, or they know if you can't hide on the battlefield. You can't hide anything really, I suppose. And I became very aware of that. I'm very aware that you have to be honest. You know, it's pointless saying we're all good and you're not. That doesn't really help anyone.
Right.
You know, so I just went right off on one then. Did I have something completely different? I'm jet lagged, John.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. But then having said that, I've had, you know, equally difficult times in the private sector. You know, it's still quite hard for me to talk about, but I remember one of my last, well, the last month that I was in Baghdad, and a very good friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, you know, died of a heart attack. And he was, you know, a Kiwi operator. I mean, one of the nicest guys, you know, brilliant guy, and used to do everything for everyone. And, you know, he sat at breakfast. And I remember being caught. Someone came running to my room, and he had a similar name to the project, our project manager. So initially, I just didn't think of his name. And then when I got to, obviously, the casualty presented themselves, and it was RAFs. And I remember just being completely, for all the things that I dealt with, I wasn't really ready for that. You know, it was a real shock. And then, you know, I'll share this, obviously, with you. And I ended up having to give him mouth to mouth. And of all that, I'm saying that as a really experienced medic. It made me feel sick, you know, just because it was extremely hard to deal with someone that close, even though I'd been through that much. And, you know, the guys around me, you know, I remember guys in the back of the ambulance when we dropped RAFs off and gave them to the PJs, you know, people were devastated. So even though I was no longer in a uniform, I still, and the guys around me were no longer in uniform, but you still feel that loss, because the team is exactly the same. You know, it's still your brothers, it's still your sisters. You don't feel any different just because you're a contractor. Right. And that's the thing, you know, fallacy some people have. They think, oh, all these guys, they're on the, you know, pop star wages, which I must say they're no longer pop star wages. But the fact is, you're still part of a brotherhood. You're still part of a team that you don't want to lose. So anything that happens is nowhere... It's no less than what you would have felt losing one of your own in the military.
Right.
So again, it's I wouldn't say that contracting is that different. It is slightly different, but it's not. You still have the same feelings, the same emotions.
Right, and you've done a total time in conflict zone as a contractor. You had like 6 years or so?
Yeah, six years. And I obviously now I'd go back and do different things, but I like to, what I can do now is I can pick, the things that mean more to me, because what means the most is my time, you know, my time with my family. So I look at a job now and it has to be worthwhile. So like the job that I'll go to next, which potentially could be in South America, is, you know, looking at helping kids. So if I feel that's worthwhile to me, then I'll go. But if it's not, then I don't. You know, I took a few jobs and I've done the carrying an umbrella down Oxford Street while someone shops, and that's not for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I've tried it. You know, I'm not knocking it. So there's some people that are very good at it. But for me, you know, my time's precious. So it has to mean something now for me to go. And that's not even just looking at dollar signs. That's actually, I have to get something personally out of a job in order to do it. So I don't know what's happening, John. I'm getting old.
Yeah. So that's all good stuff. And you know, it's just interesting to kind of see the, you know, like you said, you had different deployments and you felt like your experiences kind of helped build you up to be the best soldier and best medic that you could be at the most important or critical time in your military career, you know, with a very kinetic deployment. You know, it's all interesting stuff. And it's just interesting how people, especially medics, you know, like you can get out and there's so much work that could be done all over the planet.
Yeah.
On a medical
there is.
Type of side, you know, and it's really interesting stuff to see how like Chris, the corpsman who I had a conversation with, who we'll play that in a second.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear his story because they're a really good outfit and potentially I'd like to maybe go and work with them at some point.
Yeah, they're doing really good work and they're they're getting ready to send teams into Syria, and actually part of this episode would be to help recruit medics who would be interested to potentially go into Syria and do some work there. Yeah. So, you know, they're doing really good stuff. They have a really interesting team and different medics from, you know, all over the Western world. And it's very interesting stuff. And I know ISIS really doesn't like them. And after the first...
Really?
Yeah.
John, really?
After, it's funny because... Actually, when I first had Aaron Epstein on, the guy who...
Yeah, I've been in contact with... it's like saying contact on that. I've been in comms with Aaron. He's a very nice chap.
Yeah, and it's funny because you were on... That was the first time you were on
the podcast. Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
And shortly after that, some form of like ISIS sympathizers were like trying to hack all my shit. And, you know, I wasn't prepared for it, but this time I am prepared. So you guys can try all you want.
No, and that's the thing. It's almost like I still feel now, even, you know, I keep myself fit and strong. I can still do push-ups and all the fun stuff. But, you know, if I had to, you know, even if there was some sort of national service came back, you know, I'd have no qualms with ever going back somewhere. I think it's once it's in you, it's one of those things, isn't it?
Right.
And the way things are, you know, it's not, and it's not bravado. It's not to say, it's just a case of there's a reality here. And even whilst there was a way that attack in Berlin, that people are using vehicles as weapons. I mean, not that that's a new, but it's still, it just shows it to what levels that people sort of stooped for their goals or their, so people do need to be prepared. And that's not, you know, it's not a case of, we don't have the luxury of an ivory tower, you know, saying, oh, you know, things do need to change. But until they do change, you need to be prepared.
Right. Absolutely. And one of the good things about being prepared is now that there's so many individuals and companies that provide this kind of training and, you know, even podcasts you can listen to and people give you tips
sure you go to the right ones.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and don't waste your money on. I always think that there's plenty of guys out there, and you've had a fair few on the podcast anyway. You know that you have to check out people and make sure that they've got the relevant qualifications. Because I always get quite skeptical of if I want to go and if I wanted to go and learn to drive, I can drive, but if I wanted to go, I want someone who's had the most experience in that, you know, I'm not going to go to someone who's predominantly had a nursing experience to learn to shoot. And that's no, it doesn't mean nurses can't shoot. I'm just saying make sure someone's got the relevant sort of background and qualifications.
Right. Right. And well, you know, and another kind of good thing about that specifically is with the social media, the way it is, and so many different like prominent individuals, you can have access to these people. You can actually ask, just simply ask and say, hey, is this legit or is this legit? And you'll probably get a solid response, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Because people, you know, this, people are out sometimes, it's not nice, but there are some people out there that just are trying to take people's money. But there are really, really good schools out there, and all they cover everything that you need to know. And it not necessarily that you need to sort of barricade your house. It's just certain things, that little tips that can help, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, it's all good stuff. All good stuff. So,
are we becoming preppers, John?
Yeah, exactly.
Soon I'm going to get a t-shirt that says I'm a prepper.
Have bunkers and...
I'm preppy.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy in the United States. There's like a huge fucking
demographic of people like that. I know. Well, I know people and I love them to dearly, or love them dearly, but I know people that have got like ISO containers buried and shit. It's funny, but it's not funny. It's just, it's life, isn't it? And it's not... Yeah. I tell you, I won't be laughing when I'm saying, "Can I come and live in your ISO container, please?"
Yeah, exactly.
I'll be glad to have those friends, but no, it's cool. It's just, and I think, especially in the States, because you guys are like a gun culture also, and I think taking your guns off you would be as crazy as giving us guns.
Yeah,
because we're not a gun culture, you know. So it's almost like that's how you are, and that's, you know, very much. A society that hunts and all those different things, you know. So, a lot of the time, the hobbies and stuff are healthy.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All right, cool. So, with that being said, now I'll play the interview that I had with Chris, the former Navy corpsman who now works with the Global Surgical Medical Support Group. Hey, what's up, guys? We have a very special episode for you this week. On with me for this week's podcast is Chris, and Chris is a former Navy corpsman, but Chris is doing some very special work now with the Global Surgical Medical Support Group over in Kurdistan, or what some people might know as Northern Iraq, and they're doing very good, very important work out there and assisting and helping with the fight against ISIS. Chris, what's up, brother?
Hey, man, doing all right. Yourself?
I'm good, man. I am good. So, Chris, before we get into the work that you were doing out there in Kurdistan or Northern Iraq, can we talk about your background in the U.S. military first?
Sure. So, I started out in the Navy. Didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I heard about corpsmen, and I thought being a medic was a good route to go. So, got into that, and because I wanted to go with the Marines. So, straight after I finished my school, got sent out to 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines out in 29 Palms, California, one of the most glorious places on earth, and deployed out of there with them to Nowzad in Helmand Province. Got back, and then a few months later deployed again out to Sangin. So that was my background as a medic. We did a lot of work out there, lots of casualties. Mostly Afghans, so it was really good training.
So you spent your entire career as a corpsman attached to a Marine unit?
Yeah, Marine Infantry Unit 2-7 and 3-7. So that's all I wanted to do. Didn't really want to go back to work in a hospital, just like being out in the field with the Marines.
Right. Okay, cool. So would you be able to talk about – so like, all right. On the podcast, you know, I've had a lot of different guests on with medical backgrounds, whether it be, you know, a doctor or combat medic, you know, that sort of thing. And obviously the skills that you guys learn are extremely important. And then obviously the experiences that you guys gain while in combat on the medical side are invaluable, you know, for, you know, TCCC, things like that, bleeding control, and obviously you guys on the battlefield, you guys see some extreme stuff, blast wounds, stuff like that. In the last 15 years, 16 years of war, you know, with nonstop deployments and things moving at a very fast pace, guys are coming out of the military and they're doing some really cool things, whether it be starting their own companies and running training programs for, you know, first responders, police officers, EMTs, firefighters, or civilians as well. And it's really, you know, like from what I've noticed personally, I would say like in the last year, I've really seen a lot more of it. And I feel like they're really doing a very good job in elevating the general understanding of bleeding control and TCCC and that sort of thing for like the civilian population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really important, especially now in this day and age where you see the potential for terrorist attacks to happen absolutely anywhere. I mean, when we were flying back to the States, we were flying through Istanbul, Turkey, and you heard about the recent attack that just happened there, a mass casualty scenario. So people have the skills needed to help to treat patients in the mass casualty scenario. It's great because you really never know where it could happen.
Right. And so most of the guys that I've talked to from the medical side were Army medics, whether it was Army Soft or like a 68 whiskey. Now, I know one thing that they were doing on the Army side that was really making a difference was all of the guys in the platoon, in the unit, would have like basic training for TCCC, tourniquet use, that sort of thing. And that really made a difference where it wasn't, you know, at the point of injury, one of the guys can quickly, you know, evaluate the injury and do what they could to patch it up before the medic got there. Is that something that's happened in the Marine Corps as well?
Oh, definitely. Marines, all our units. So before we deploy, we would make sure that every Marine in our platoon had been through a combat lifesaver class and was trained in the whole PMARCH-B category and TCCC. So they were all proficient in putting tourniquets on to stop the bleeding or applying direct pressure with pressure dressings. They could all do needle decompressions. They would know the signs and symptoms and the contraindications for why they do needle decompressions. Most all of them were good with IVs. They could all start lines on patients. So there were some Marines that I was like, man, you're pretty much a corpsman yourself. You're a medic. So we're pretty confident in our Marines being able to take care of each other.
Right. That's awesome. So for the corpsman like training pipeline, all of that is done in the Navy and then you switch over to the Marine Corps. How does that work exactly?
Yeah. So you start out at a corpsman school. It's called your A school, and that's 3 months long. And that's just kind of a basic overview, like EMT type course where you just get your feet wet a little bit. And after that, you just go to a school called Field Medical Training Battalion. I went to the one out in Camp Pendleton, and that's run jointly by Marines and corpsmen. And that's where they transition you over to the Marine side of things. It's kind of a mix of like Marine boot camp and SOI School of Infantry, where they teach you just basics of the Marine lifestyle and how to work with then fire teams, how to buddy rush, marksmanship. And then once you finish that, you get sent out to your Marine unit. Once you get sent out to your Marine unit, then they send you to, if you're going to a combat unit, we call them victory units, like 3-7, 2-7 infantry battalions, they will send you out to another school called combat trauma medicine. And that's the best training you get in the military. That's where you have life tissue training. So they'll have like a pig, and the pig will be sedated, and then they'll go ahead and do all sorts of, give it all sorts of injuries. They'll cut a leg off, they'll shoot it in the chest, they'll give it burns, and they'll have you treat it. So they run through pretty much almost every scenario you could get with a patient, and you get that hands-on application with a live pig. And that's really useful for the training you get downfield.
Right. And how long would that entire process, because, and the reason I'm asking is because a lot of the audience on the podcast would be young men and women who aspire to join the military and possibly, you know, become a corpsman or become a 68 whiskey or, you know, a special operations medic. So I'm asking just so that, you know, this demographic of Americans can kind of get an understanding of what to expect and what it could be like and kind of equip them prior to entry with the best tools possible, you know? So how long would you say that process is for becoming a corpsman who's going to be attached to a Marine infantry unit from the moment you begin your training to the moment you're ready to deploy?
It takes about a year. That's why all medics with the Navy, all corpsmen, they usually sign 5-year contracts because you need that extra year for the training, all the schools they'll send you to in order to be ready to deploy. And there's always extra schools you send it to. Like I went to cold weather medicine training up in Bridgeport, California, where they put you up in the mountains and teach you all sorts of ways to take care of cold weather casualties. So it's usually about a year long that it takes you to finish everything.
Okay, cool. And now, you know, we have different guests on the podcast, you know, different from all different kind of backgrounds and different experiences. Majority of the guys, men and women, have deployments, you know, combat experience to Afghanistan, to Iraq and elsewhere. Would you be able to, you know, possibly share a story with the audience, maybe of a time in combat where you were you treated a casualty?
Yeah. My second deployment that I went on, we were really focused on just assisting and training the Afghans to fight in Afghanistan. It shifted from Americans taking the lead to the ANA, the Afghan National Army, taking the lead, and they were out there and staying in manning most of the PBs and FOBs out there, and we were their support. But with that shift, they start taking a lot more casualties, lots of mass casualties as well. Their vehicles and their equipment they have is not as well designed to take on explosions as our vehicles were. So there was one scenario where there was a mass casualty, and a couple of their vehicles that struck IEDs, and we were like the QRF for them, and they alerted us to that. So we went out to help out. I was with a group of 3 other Marines, and they were great help in that situation because all of them could do the basic interventions needed to help save lives, putting on tourniquets, occlusive dressings, neodecompressions. So when these 2 vehicles got hit by IEDs, there's about 20 casualties total. And when we showed up to a scene, it was really chaotic. And we just started triaging, started going, all right, who's alive? Who needs care right now? And we had everything from triple amputees to just minor burns. But having all my Marines trained up to the standard that they could all perform casualty care efficiently was great, because it wasn't just me, the medic, out there trying to treat all these casualties. It was like each of us had 4 casualties, and we all go checking up on them. And once we finished the initial interventions and got them somewhat stabilized, we were able to get the medevac and take them to a higher level of care.
Right. And for the audience who might not know, can you explain what a triage is?
Yeah. So triage is in a tactical situation, you're trying to keep as many guns up in the fight as possible. So you have a limited amount of resources. You know, when you're out in the field, you usually only have as a medic, you have a med bag. Your Marines have a small individual first aid kit, maybe an extra CLS bag, which is a combat lifesaver bag. So you're very limited in equipment, so you can't just devote all your equipment and time to one patient. You have different categories of triage. So when you're on the field, you have your green level, which is guys that you just need minor care, and they could get up in the fight and keep rounds down range in order to keep the enemy down. Then there's red patients, which need care quickly or they're going to die. So those are like the two ones we focus on the most. But you're trying to keep as many patients alive as long as possible with limited resources. So, yeah.
So it's kind of like also, you know, saying like categorizing, you know, the injuries, saying who may need more attention and who do we need to get out of here? And then maybe the guys with smaller injuries, we can patch them up quickly and they can continue the fight, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you're really making a decision on like who lives and who dies sometimes. But one of the things you realize in combat and with combat casualties is that there's lots of people who sometimes, no matter what you do, they're not going to be able to live. So you have to be able to recognize those type of casualties and move on and take care of the guys that you can save and you can make a difference in.
Right. Right. Okay. So, and how long total were you in the Marine Corps?
I was told for 5 years.
Okay.
5 years, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, all right. So now we can talk more about recent events. Obviously, there's a lot going on in Kurdistan or northern Iraq, as some people may know it, with the Kurds are really fighting heavily against ISIS in Kurdistan, and as well as on the Syrian side, there's a heavy Kurdish population, and they're also fighting ISIS in Syria as well. Previously on the podcast, I had a gentleman by the name of Aaron Epstein on the podcast, and he runs an organization called the Global Surgical Medical Support Group, and they do very good work. They're out there now, and they've been out there for a while now, providing medical training for Kurdish medics as well as treating casualties. Now, if anyone who's listening has been following them on social media, they post pictures. Sometimes they post videos, but mainly pictures showing some of the work that they're doing. They do a lot of good work. And Chris, you have been working with this group now, and you just got back from a trip out there. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So we just did about a 3-week trip out there in northern Iraq, working with the Kurdish military and government. It was my first time out there working with the Kurdish people, and I was impressed. Our mission was to train their medics in TCCC and CLS, tactical combat, casualty care. So we were trying to train them up to the standards that the coalition forces are trained up to, the way we're trained here in the States, similar to a course that Marines and Army guys would go through before deploying overseas. We had our group split up in two. We had the doctors and surgeons, which were working out of a hospital. And then we had the medical team, which was six medics. And three of us are from the States, prior veterans, and three were from Norway. And together we would go to different bases and areas throughout northern Iraq and hold 2-day courses on TCCC. And we were able to train about 450 different Peshmerga medics and just regular infantry guys on these skills. So we started out close to just south of Mosul, at a military base there. And the first group we had was medics. And they had some previous training, but we were able to go deeper into it and teach them some other skills. One of the things I learned when going on this trip was improvising. So, you know, with the U.S. military, we have some of the best equipment medically wise. We have tourniquets are given to everybody. Everyone has IFACs, that individual first aid kits, that are stocked. If we need something, usually we ask for it and we're going to get it. But with these guys out there, their equipment is very limited. So instead of training them the way that we treat our medics with our gear. We had to improvise and come up with different ways to make tourniquets. These guys, most of them don't have any tourniquets at all. So it's easy to go there and be like, oh, yeah, it's easy to stop a bleeding. And they're like, well, how do you do that with a tourniquet? And they ask you, what's a tourniquet?
Oh, okay.
So then you have to break it down for them and show them how to use the equipment they have, like scarves, clothing, and to make improvised tourniquets. Same thing with chest seals. You know, they don't have these fancy halo chest seals we have here in the States. So we just show them how to take a piece of plastic and tape it down on four sides to make their own improvised occlusive dressing. So a lot of adapting on this trip we had to do with the way we taught our courses. But these Kurdish medics were, and just regular infantry Peshmerga medics, they were very motivated to learn. They I've worked with Afghans before in Afghanistan, and the difference between the two was quite stark. So lots of times working with the Afghans, we felt like they didn't want to really work with us much. They, at least this is from my experience, were not very motivated. But with working with the Peshmerga, these guys were very, very quick learners, and they wouldn't fall asleep in class. We'd be going for hours, and they would be up the whole time listening and asking questions, trying to figure out better ways to provide medical care.
That's pretty interesting. It's an interesting concept, because I know, you know, the Global Surgical Medical Support Group, they rely heavily on donations for equipment and that sort of thing. So I could imagine that you guys would have to be doing some sort of improvising out there. But that's pretty interesting, though.
Yeah. We did have a lot of equipment we took with us that was donated, but there's a vast need for equipment out there in northern Iraq. These guys need absolutely everything. So we've had around $700,000 worth of equipment donated, and we still have more donations coming into GSMSG centers here in the States that's getting pushed out there to these guys out on the front lines who are fighting ISIS. But we did have to do a lot of improvising, but you find ways when you need to save a life. You find ways to do what you need to do.
Yeah, and I could imagine as well with the offensive and the push to retake Mosul, that there was an increase in casualties. And I know that from following you guys on social media, they were on some of the posts they had. They were talking about how there was going to be, you know, they were going to have to treat more casualties. You know, they were expecting that with this new offensive that was going to take place. Were you doing any of that, or were you just involved in the training side of it?
Since we were working with the Kurdish government, we were more involved with the training, because right now in Mosul, most of the city is not part of the Kurdish territory. Most of it belongs to the regular Iraqi government. So they're not sending in their Peshmerga to take over the city. They're letting the Shia and the Sunni militias go in there and take the city, because it would cause more problems if you send in Kurdish troops to that area.
Right.
So because we're working with the Kurdish government, we weren't treating the casualties coming out of there, which were Shia or Sunni casualties. So there's a big rift in Iraq between the three, as has been well documented, between the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni. So you don't want to send in guys to cause a worse problem. So we were mostly towards by the front lines, close to the bases that the Peshmerga were at, and we were training the guys for the next push that's going to be coming. There's still parts of Kurdistan which are close to the fight farther up north, like in Sinjar. We were out there training out one of the bases, and they started taking mortars from ISIS and some gunfire. But where we were focused on getting out in the field and working out there, our mission was to train the medics that were going to be going out in the field.
Right. Okay, cool. And you plan on continuing to do work with the GSM GC?
Yeah. There's more trips coming up. You mentioned earlier a trip to Syria that is going to be happening. So they're trying to recruit guys for that right now. Any prior like SF medics or ex-corpsmen that have some good combat experience, love to go on that trip, should apply and get into it. Syria is still a crazy, crazy place right now, and they need a lot of medical support for casualties. So, yeah, I plan on going back at some point, hopefully to Syria, maybe back to Iraq. What we're trying to do is the guys who went on this trip right now is take each of us, take our own teams out there and team of four or five guys. And since we've already been there before, be able to take a new group in and do the same thing again. This way expand the effect that GSMSU can have out there and train a greater number of medics.
Cool. So for anyone who's interested in applying to work with you guys, where can they do that?
They could go on GSMSG's website, or you could if you follow them on Instagram, you could get on their page and follow the links over to their website. And then there's an application process, very basic. Put your name, phone number, email, a little bit of information about yourself, resume, and they're pretty good at getting back to you and letting you know what you need to do next. So it's a great opportunity for all former military members. They want to have an impact on what's going on overseas with ISIS and helping train troops out there to be successful on the battlefield. I definitely recommend it.
Okay, so the website is gsmsg.org. So again, anyone who's interested, you can go to that handle, gsmsg.org. They have a contact tab and a join our team tab. And from there, you just fill out the form. And then, you know, I guess there's a process going back and forth of vetting and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And they're on Facebook and on Instagram. If you want to follow them on there, keep up with the work they're doing and or support them, that'd be great.
Right, and as well as, you know, following them, even if it's someone who's willing to contribute, maybe you don't have a military background, they also accept donations. And like I said earlier, they take gear donations as well. So tourniquets, you know, dressing, that kind of thing, they accept that. And they have, I believe they have a P.O. box where some of the stuff can be sent to. What kind of equipment would you say would be accepted or would be acceptable to send?
Big need we have is tourniquets, occlusive dressings, gauze, needle decompression, any equipment. If it hasn't been used, it's still new, definitely send it in. But all these first responder type equipment, trauma shears, med bags, most tourniquets are the most important. That's the number one things people are dying from is blood loss out there. That's easily preventable. So any type of airway equipment like King LTs, intubation kits, cry kits, all those would be great use.
Awesome, man. Awesome. It's, you know, it's always good to have somebody from the organization on, especially someone like yourself with a military medical background. You know, we appreciate everything you've done for this country and as well as the work that you're still doing in helping stop and counter a group like ISIS that really has no place in today's world and today's society. So, you know, we appreciate everything you do, man, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate being able to talk about the trip and spread more awareness about GSMSG and ways people can help.
Yeah, all right, brother. Thanks, man. Thank you for coming on, and I appreciate everything.
All right, John. Take care.
Peace. Great conversation with Chantel and Chris, former Navy corpsman, now working with the GSMSG. They're doing incredible work in Iraq, and soon we'll be going into Syria. So any soft medics, 18 Deltas, Sarks, Corman, you know, 68 Whiskeys, anybody who's interested in doing some work and contributing to the fight, you can check out and apply at their website. And also for anyone, any of the listeners, anyone who is a regular audience to the show, if you know anyone who might be potentially a good guest for the podcast, or if you yourself have a background and experience in the military or combat, just reach out to me at podcast@globalrecon.net. And, you know, we could talk further. And also for any of the audience, if you have anything that you think would be interesting to listen to, or a certain individual who might be good for the show, you can reach out as well. And we can talk about that further. So with that being said, now I'll close out this week's podcast. As always, subscribe, download, share the podcast with your family and friends. Help us continue to grow. Chantel Taylor is on Instagram at @mission_critical. I post on there as well. On Facebook, her Facebook account is Battle Worn, The Memoirs of a Combat Medic in Afghanistan. You can also check out Chantel's book. It's a very good book. It's called Battle Worn. The easiest place to get it is on Amazon. Check it out. My website is globalrecon.net. My Facebook account is FB Recon. My Instagram account is IG Recon. The second one is Black Ops Matter. I'm on Twitter at IG Recon. I'm on LinkedIn. Just search Global Recon. Enjoy doing this episode. Next week, we'll have another good episode for you guys. And we'll see you then. Peace.